Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, the Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading today World Radio Magazine for April 2008 in digest form. World Radio is published by Armand Noble. His call is N6WR. The editor is Nancy Cott, WZ8C. Their offices are located at World Radio Incorporated, 2120 28th Street, Sacramento, California, 95818. You can call them at area 916-457-3655. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. And Handy Ham is spelled here always, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word, handyham@courage.org. The website, www.handyham.org. We'll begin today in the editor's log. The editor again, Nancy Cott. K-O-T-T, call, Whiskey Zulu 8, Charlie. Okay, I admit it. We were unable to resist the temptation of April Fool's Day and had more than a little fun putting this issue together. It all began when Ray Deal, the third, offered his services as a guest columnist for the monthly Rose and Regs column. John Johnson, W3BE, agreed to take a short vacation and stepped aside so Mr. Dio could share his interesting perspective on amateur radio regulation topics with you. Mr. Dio has been a regular April contributor for many years, and we are happy to have his words of wisdom in the magazine again this year. I couldn't resist printing the fascinating story of pheromonic propagation theory by John Rudy, called K3QF. Having had Ant 1 and Ant 2 buttons on my rigs for years, we finally discovered their real purpose. I also found that after reading this article, I understand propagation much better, particularly the role of the G layer. The pheromonic propagation theory puts things in a whole new perspective. We ran a story about strange antennas in the September 2007 issue. The author, Arnold Solomon, KC4ZUA, received many requests for detailed construction instructions of the soda pop can antenna. Remember that one? Although this may seem like an April Fool's article, Arnold assures us that it does indeed work and is fun to build. For more strange antennas and information about the 2008 Strange Antenna Challenge, that's 24th through 26 May, keep an eye on the webpage www.n0ew.org/K0S/. Where is the wackiest or most impressive place you've worn your Kurt N. Sturba hat? Send us a photo, and we'll give the best ones a shot at the big time by actually printing a photo in the Aerials column in the near future. So put on your Kurt N. Sturba hat, which can also do double duty as a thinking cap, and get creative. It is the ultimate honor for Kurt fans. You can email your photo as a JPEG to nancy@tir.com. or to World Radio via postal mail. A heated discussion about where does the power go has been continuing between engineers and physics heavyweights, such as Cecil Moore, W5DXP, Dr. Stephen Best, VE9, SRL, and Walt Maxwell, W2DU, for over 20 years. World Radio published a series of articles by Cecil Moore in issues October 2005 and January 2006. Mr. Moore has again written another three-part series, and we invite you to visit his webpage and check it out, as well as the other numerous dissertations posted on the page. The webpage can be found at www.w5dxp.com/. Congratulations to our QRP columnist, Richard Fisher, KI6SN, on the anniversary of his 15th year of writing the QRP column. Be People may think it's easy to churn out a column, but we know how much time and hard work goes into it. Thanks, Richard. Next month is the Date and Hamvention. As you have undoubtedly heard before, it is one show you do not want to miss. Isn't it funny how people you only see once a year seem like old friends? I bet that only happens in amateur radio. Publishers Arnold and Helen Noble will be there. I'll be zipping between the World Radio booth and the Fists booth. The World Radio booth is in the main arena backing up the Kenwood display, which takes up most of the center of the arena. We're on the corner. You can't miss it. I haven't gotten confirmation of the Fists location yet, but if it is the same as previous years, we'll be on the ramp that connects the sit-down cafeteria area and the main arena. Many of our columnists will be attending the convention. If you see them, be sure to let them know you enjoy their columns and tell them any suggestions you have for future topics. We look forward to having an eyeball. 73-88-33. Nancy Cott, WZ8C. Ladies and gentlemen, the commentary made by Nancy Cott about pharaohmonic propagation brings me to that particular article. Pharaohmonic is spelled P-H-E-R-O-M-O-N-E-I-C, I think. It's by John Rudy. John's current call is K3QF, Kilo 3, Quebec Foxtrot. He has many DX calls from past experiences. A startling new discovery into the nature of propagation reveals some heretofore unknown facts about the way we really communicate by radio. This is the story of discovery, the story of unexpected mesoscientific findings that prove true and the closer you are to the warm tropical sun. By the call signs behind my name, preceded by an X, you can see I have lived much of my life in tropical places. When I moved to a new location, I obtained a license as soon as possible, erecting antennas and set up my shack. On my last hitch overseas in the Philippines, I noticed a lack of propagation from my little island in the far corner of Asia. It was difficult to eke out QSOs with anyone using standard wire antennas. How could this be? I wondered. My exotic call sign had usually netted a pileup after the first few CQs. With lack of propagation, my main activity while CQing was studying the noise, which dances on the bandscope of my IC-756 for the slight hint of propagation to anywhere. 6-meter ops will recognize at once the nirvana-like state that white noise generates in the CPU between the ears. This trance was broken as I caught a flash of movement out of the corner of my eye, a signal materializing from the ether, which spiked on a display. No, something smaller. It was an ant crawling out of my radio. Funny, I thought, this ant was inside my rig. I was irked at this small creature that could potentially gum up a relay, pot, or switch on my radio. I was ready to mash the little bugger when I began to formulate a theory that linked this ant to the hows and the whys of my hard luck propagation. I followed the ant as it crawled down my operating desk and toward the window where it scrambled up my antenna coax cable. My gaze followed as it marched, joined by other companions up my RG8X feed line dangling from a coconut tree. Lo and behold, by the apex of the antenna there was a constant stream of the little critters, a venerable 8-lane highway, with one stream of ants going up and the other down. I pondered just how these minuscule insects could affect my ability to communicate. As I observed the busy body scurrying to and fro, a new theory of propagation began to form in my mind. My observations are preliminary, but see if you can follow the trail of my thoughts. You see, ants communicate by pheromone. Say one ant finds an inadvertently dropped morsel of meat, such as ham. Yes, ants are carnivorous, and they get very excited about that piece of information. They then pass the good news of their find on to the entire tribe by generating a specific subatomic scent, S-C-E-N-T. When an ant finds a meal, senses danger, or stumbles into a radio, it communicates to its comrades by the parascientific term of pheromonic transmission, generating what is called GPS, or grid pheromonic scent. Applying this to ham radio and propagation, we discover some valuable pieces to our theory. As I key my radio, the ants, their feelers held high, adjust their pheromones according to my modulation mode, thus causing bunching of ants along their pathway. This modulated ant clump travels up the stream of ants on the feed line to the antenna and out the antenna element. This gives a brand new meaning to technical understanding of standing waves. I now tune for maximum standing waves because this assures me that there are the greatest number of legs standing on my radiator at any given instant. Hence, the most ants to yield the maximum pheromonic radiation. I suspect that the Japanese have known about this form of propagation for a few years. My Icon radio has an ant, one, and an ant, two, position. My investigations have isolated a few sizes of ants that correlate to the buttons on my radio that we call bands. Note in my figure 1, which is in the article, that the smallest ant corresponds to the 50 megahertz band. I have isolated the 10, 15, and 20 meter ants. I have not yet been able to find the low band ants, but have this strange sensation of being watched when I am on the top band. 160 meters. Using this theory, I have discovered two things about propagation that have maximized my radiation patterns and thus my QSO rate. First, I have quit squashing the ants on and around my radio and computer every time I spy one. Who knows? The one I squash could have been the one that made the link with some rare DX, Central New Jersey, for example. The second is to notice when the geckos, little bugs eating lizards, are prolific. These petite reptiles pop ants by the dozens as if they were candy. I have developed a new rule of propagation that states, quoting, when the G layer absorption, gecko layer absorption that is high, I play basketball with my sons and forget the radio, close quotation. Understanding this theory does have its practical operating applications. So there you go, folks. Think about that. What a marvelous concept. In amateur radio, ant one and ant two. We also just mentioned that soda pop can vertical dipole. There's a bit of information relative to the construction details on page 14 of World Radio, April 2008. 2 meter soda pop can vertical dipole. The author Arnold Solomon called KC4ZUA, Kilo Charlie 4 Zulu, Uniform Alpha. The original 2 meter soda pop can vertical dipole was constructed for the 2007 Strange Antenna Challenge. After measuring a number of different can types, it was determined that a stack of 4 aluminum soda pop cans was within 0.2 inches of the calculated value for a quarter wavelength element. After completion of the antenna, an SWR of 1.7 to 1, not bad, was measured during testing. To construct an antenna, each can is fastened to the can below it with 3 sheet metal screws to form an antenna element. The secret to fastening the cans together is to use hex head self-drilling number 6 times 1/2-inch sheet metal screws. A 1/4-inch magnetic-tipped nut setter is used with the 4.5-inch shaft extension to reach through the wide mouth opening of the can to drive the screws. Each element consists of 4 cans. After the 2 elements are complete, the top of the 2 elements are removed with the set of circular cutting aviation snips. The 2 elements are joined together with a short piece of 1 1/2-inch Schedule 40 PVC pipe. The connection points to the feed line are sanded to remove the can's outer coating. The coaxial feed line is joined to the cans with sheet metal screws tapped into the PVC pipe. It is recommended that a good quality coaxial cable of foam or Teflon construction be used with VHF antennas to prevent unnecessary losses. Before installing the completed antenna, it should be tested for SWR on 2 meters using the low power setting of your 2-meter transmitter. As SWR bridges are frequency sensitive, a VHF bridge should be used to ensure accurate readings. The original antenna was designed for only temporary use, so no effort was made to seal the antenna with a coating of protective clear paint. The 2008 Strange Antenna Challenge will soon be upon us as it is scheduled for the Memorial Day weekend, 24 May through 26 May. For details relative to that, you can go to the web, if you have internet connection, to http://www.nzew.org/k0s/. W0S, Whiskey Zero Sierra, Special Event Station, the 96th anniversary of the Titanic disaster. Author Dave Sapp, that's S-A-P, Beckler, called WA0SAP. One would have to wonder on the night of 14 April 1912 what the weather conditions were on the deck of the unsinkable Titanic. We know from history it was a clear, crisp, cold night, with the Titanic full speed ahead towards an ice field, disregarding all the warnings of trouble that lay in her path, with passengers on deck as the cold wind blew in their faces on her maiden voyage. Last year, the operators of the special event station W0S may have faced the same conditions. The weather was beautiful 2 weeks prior to the event. The trees were starting to bloom with all the signs of spring in the air. Then out of the north, an Arctic front blew in, dropping temperatures 25 degrees below normal. Rain turned into hail and then to snow, with winds blowing up to 35 miles per hour. This surely made the event memorable. One could only dream we were living the day of the Titanic in 1912. Amateur radio operators Dave Sapp Beckler, WA0SAP Rick Vogt, WB9YZE, Al Gallo, W0ERE, and Rod Kittleman, K0ADI, organized this special event station along with Mary Kellogg, part owner of the world's largest Titanic museum in Branson, Missouri. You can visit the website of the museum at www.titanicbranson.com. One of the interesting things about the Titanic is that people of all ages, from grade school kids on up, know something of this tragic event. People all over the world are students of history, historians of the Titanic, or just know two facts about the Titanic. Those two facts are that it hit an iceberg and sank, or that it was the first time SOS was used in a distress situation. Well, the latter of the two is not exactly true. The distress signal SOS used on the Titanic was not the new distress call. In fact, the International Maritime enacted SOS in 1908. It was CQD that was required to be used by Mr. Marconi on all his transmitters. On board the Titanic was a Marconi spark gap transmitter, and the chief radio operator, Jack Phillips, was a diehard for sending the CQD during his time of distress. It was Harold Bride, the second operator, who harped on Phillips to send the SOS call. "Send SOS, it's the new call, and it may be your last chance to send it," Bride said. So this special event station was born on the idea that the world's largest Titanic museum was located in Branson, Missouri. It is to honor the two brave radio operators, John George, Jack Phillips, and Harold Bride. These two radio operators stayed to the final minutes before being relieved by Captain Smith, who said, "You have performed your job very well. It's every man for himself." Both operators jumped into the chilly waters of the North Atlantic. Jack Phillips almost made it to one of the lifeboats, but hypothermia had a major effect on his ability to save himself, and he was lost at sea. Harold Bride successfully made it to a lifeboat and lived until he passed away in 1956. Captain Smith went down with his ship, which ironically was to have been his last command for the White Star Line. Last year, our press release hit 111 newswire services in 2 days. From that press release, we were published in Yacht Magazine, as well as Golf Digest. Now, don't ask me what golf has to do with the Titanic. Most ask why the world's largest Titanic museum is dry docked in the middle of the country. Branson is a hot place for tourists. I guess that is why a full-scale replica of Noah's Ark is presently being built inside a theater here. Branson is a family entertainment center. Therefore, last year, we decided to open this event to all hams to come operate the special event station, W0S, Whiskey Zero Sierra. This year is the 96th anniversary of the Titanic disaster. The dates are 12 through 13 April. Please check our website for starting and ending times at www.w0s.org. This site is also good for updates as this event grows, as well as QSL information. This is a multi-mode event, meaning all hams from around the world or any class license can contact the W0S station via single sideband, high frequency, CW Morse code, packet, D-Star, 2 meters, Echolink, or IRLP. If you cannot make it this year, pencil us in for the 97th anniversary and bring the whole family to Branson, Missouri. That concludes the article, W0S Special Event, the 96th anniversary of the Titanic disaster, by Dave Sapp Beckler, WA0SAP. While I'm on this page, we have a couple of special events. Shark's Tooth Festival. Tamiami Amateur Radio Club will operate special event station K4S, Kilo 4 Sierra, from the annual Venus Shark's Tooth Festival, 11 through 13 April 2008, 1300 through 2400 Zulu, or Universal Time Constant, or until the bands close. Suggested frequencies 21.313, 18.153, 14.236, and 7.233 megahertz. For photo QSL describing the festival, send QSL and a self-addressed-stamped envelope to Jack Sprout, S-P-R-O-A-T, call W4JS, 1419 East Minnesota Beach Road, Englewood, Florida, 34223. Also special event, 54th birthday celebration. Grays Harbor Amateur Radio Club will operate special event station W7ZA, that's Whiskey 7 Zulu Alpha, 26-27 April 2008, from Bowerman Airfield Tower, Hoquiam, Washington State. CW, phone, SSTV, PSK31, QSL with SASE2, GHARC, call W7ZA, PO Box 2250, Aberdeen, Washington, zip code 98520. If you'd like to check them out on the internet, it's www.gharc.org. There's a big advertisement here. It's not really an advertisement, but it's an advertisement. It's about CPAC, S-E-A-P-A-C, ARRL's Northwestern Division Ham Convention. It's on May 30th, May 31st, and June 1st of 2008. They're encouraging you to plan now to attend the Northwest's largest ham convention, CPAC, Slant Pacific Ham Convention, Seaside Convention Center, Seaside, Oregon. There'll be a HEAL, sound workshop, seminars, prizes, banquet. There's going to be FCC Riley Hollingworth for the banquet speaker, DX Luncheon, YLRL Luncheon, Dealers Exhibits, VE Testing, Manufacturers, 100-plus Flea Market Tables, a shuttle bus. For early booth reservations, please respond via CPAC, P.O. Box 25466, Portland, Oregon, zip code 97298-0466, or call Al, the name, W7SIC, Whiskey 7 Sierra, India Charlie, at 503-816-7098 at any time. For motel assistance in Oregon, you can contact the Bureau there, 1-800-444-6740. Others, you can try 503-738-6391. For any of you folks that use Logbook of the World from the ARRL, there's a nice article here in the section DX World, authored by Kelly Jones and Zero VD. It's rather lengthy and reasonably technical. So if you have internet connections, you can check out Logbook of the World for new details. Also in the DX World commentary, there's a reminder of the Visalia and Dayton. They are upon us. It's once again that time of year, the time when DXers come from around the world to attend two of the most well-known events in DXing and ham radio in general, the Visalia, California, DX Convention, and the Dayton, Ohio, Hamvention. This year will be the 59th anniversary International DX Convention and will again take place at the Holiday Inn and Conference Center in Visalia, California. As always, this year's event is sure to bring out some of the biggest names in DXing. During the three-day event, there will be an abundance of activities for attendees, including forums, vendor showcases, the big DX dinner, and nightlife activities. Some of the past activities have included DXCC card checking, top band forums, and DXpedition speakers. Of course, there was always a good showing of vendors and plenty of door prizes. Visalia is not only a chance to meet the guys on the other end of the pileups, but also an opportunity to compare notes with your peers. For more information on the Visalia DX Convention, be sure to check out their website at www.dxconvention.org. Mark your calendars for 25 to 27 April, and see you at Visalia. With the coming of Visalia, it also means the Dayton Hamvention is just around the corner. Dayton is arguably one of the premier hamfests in the world and comes with a complete lineup for the DXers. The DX forums are typically held on Saturday at Hara Arena and are well worth attending. Over the years, there have been speakers from various DX expeditions, including BS7H, ZL8R, and KH8SI. In addition, prominent figures in the DX community have given interesting talks on the history of DXing and where it is heading. This year's Hamvention runs from 16 through 18 May and is certain to be an event you don't want to miss. Staying with the DXing situation, for those of you that obviously have interest in Iraq because of the tremendous length of time that has gone on with our country involved in that part of the world, there is some information about Iraqi radio transmitting. The Stafford, Virginia DX Association, its acronym is SDXA, recently announced that one of its members, Radar, that's a name, K2PT, not of MASH fame, a Marine in Baghdad, has obtained a license and should be on the air as YI9PT, Yankee India 9, Papa Tango, by the time you read this. SDXA members N4NW, K4HR, N4XP, N1DG, and OK1KT are providing logistical support and are in the process of acquiring an amp, that's an amplifier, and low-band antennas for him. Radar has received an ICOM 7000 on loan from ICOM. NCDXF and INDEXA are providing funds for a purchase of a STEP IR2, element beam, and other basic station gear. Initial operations will be on 17 and 20 meters utilizing a wire antenna until a STEP IR Yagi shipped by the support team arrives. Once fully operational, activity will be on 160 through 10 meters. All QSL requests go to November 4, X-Ray Papa, N4XP. Complete information may be found on the SDXA website at http://www.stafford-dx-association.org. World Radio, April 2008. Again, thanks, DX columnist Kelly Jones, for the input. Kelly's call, N0VD. I have a silent key announcement here. David J. Leiser, L-E-I-S-E-R, call K3NPX. David J. Leiser, 65, died 1st January 2008, Beaver, Pennsylvania. Dave was a group leader with Westinghouse Electric and the Cutler Hammer of Beaver, retiring with 35 years of service. He was an amateur radio operator for 51 years and belonged to the AAA Amateur Radio Association, where he was president for 20 years. He was an emergency coordinator for Beaver County for 25 years, served on the staff of the Emergency Operations Center of Beaver County for many years, and belonged to the American Red Cross Disaster Services. David J. Leiser, K3NPX, Silent Key. We thank Pat Summers, KE3WN, for that obituary notice. Let's skip along now to Emergency Communications. Learn to Look for Clues. Author Jerry Wellman, call W7SAR, Whiskey 7 Sierra Alfa Romeo. Emergency response is often best considered as a mystery story, where your main job, as coordinator, is to uncover all of the little details that lead you to the correct solution. When it works out well, people live. The challenge for instructors is to impact the ability and intuition to someone that they may be a better clue finder. It's a difficult process to develop exercises that both teach and cause the student to develop the ability to uncover clues. I recall a search years ago in Utah for an aircraft that simply vanished on a long flight. No disaster signals, no emergency beacon, no immediate clues. There were some leads that developed, but we were stumped. We finally found someone who had helped the pilot load a casket into the plane. It turned out he was doing a favor for a family by transporting a casket for a burial in Montana to save the family money a funeral home would charge for ground transportation. We asked the funeral home if there was anything about the casket that may affect the search. It turns out the body had been packed with dry ice, which is frozen carbon dioxide. As the plane cabin could be pressurized, the likely scenario was lack of oxygen. When the casket was checked, it was not airtight, and there was no dry ice. Unfortunately, the pilot did not survive, but uncovering the clues caused the search team to expand the search area based on projections for a pilot to be affected by release of carbon dioxide. I used this scenario to teach a search coordinator course. One student was very upset. He said, "This could not have possibly happened. You're making this up." I showed him the investigation report. Often these reports take from 6 months to a year to be published, but here's the lesson for you in developing training scenarios. Work backwards. Select events that provide you, the instructor, with most, if not all, the clues. You can find investigation reports from the National Transportation Safety Board that work well. The NTSB not only investigates aircraft accidents, but train wrecks, pipeline breaks, bus crashes, and etc. The information in many NTSB reports is quite detailed and often gives a great timeline as to what happened and in what order. These reports make for great exercise fodder, and you can write in a communications component. Writing a tabletop event takes some time and attention to detail. In my file cabinet of exercises, I only have a dozen or so, as they take so long to properly prepare. I personally try to avoid training events other people have developed or those found in FEMA training materials, as everyone knows the answers, so they don't try to find the right clues. The worst time at a tabletop is to have a spoiler say in a loud voice, "Neat, I've seen this scenario before and the butler did it." I try to develop one or two objectives for a scenario. For a radio setting, my objective might be to simply establish a comm network to support this event. And a scenario might move from a local event to an extended event as facts unfold, or as the weather gets bad, and so forth. You might want students to consider a complex network to support several unseen resources, or to compensate for power outages or repeater failures. A good scenario contains a timeline of events that lead up to resource activation. Include a map so students can get a visual overview. In some cases, I have photographs of the terrain or of various facilities the team might be using. You are also prepared to lead the event by injecting various details that create the challenge for students to solve. I try to avoid injecting facts not found in the real event. Just select a real event that is bizarre or challenging enough and you'll do okay. Remember, the idea is to give students an opportunity, so look at and create situations for a real event. If you keep injecting non-real facts, you're not teaching. You're confusing. Finally, keep your scenario short. If you have some specific objectives, you can effectively teach the concept in a couple of hours at most. After that, you're going to lose your students and they get silly and unfocused. Once the students have developed plans on how to meet the challenge, I like to give them the rest of the story so they can then see all of the facts and how the event ended. Then we discuss other scenarios based on them now having all the facts. Often I find some of the best learning happens after we have all the facts and know how it turned out. In that light, I recommend you look at the final investigation reports of various incidents. It's a great learning tool for you to sit and ponder how you would have set up a command post or communications for, let's say, a bus crash on a remote highway where no cell phone coverage existed. I find it a good mental exercise to read the final report and put myself in the role of incident commander or operations chief or communications unit leader. In the privacy of my own study, I can explore ideas and just think. I'm not saying that every idea I have is of merit, but the thinking process is what's important. When called to perform, you may have some ideas that might work. If you've not pondered what I call response ideas, you're starting behind a curve. We're going now to HF Mobile, Noise and Ground Answers. The author, Les Cobb, COBB, call W6TEE, Whiskey 6, Tango Echo Echo. Here are some good hands-on noise answers from Carl Young, K5HK, in Reno. Quoting, I have a 2004 Highlander, all-wheel drive with a trailer hitch-mounted High Sierra 180 antenna on it. I use it mostly on 40 meters lower sideband. I noted a good deal of ignition noise into my IC7K rig. My solution, a combination of good grounding, which didn't help too much, but certainly helped the 40-meter performance. I normally use the IC7K with a good deal of noise reduction on the receiver. I still had ignition based on speed of engine, especially for frequency and load on the engine. I put on the receiver noise blanker and noted a reduction of ignition noise by several S units, which makes it very usable on 40-meter single sideband. A note on ground bonding from the antenna. I used two each 2-inch wide copper wire straps to each side of the body, not frame, of the vehicle. I drilled holes, then used a wire brush on a drill to clean off all paint about an inch around them, coated the ends and bare body with antioxidant, and used a 1/4-inch self-tapping bolt to secure the straps to the body under the back, and ran these solid copper ground straps to each side of the body in the back. Every time I work 40 meters, I get comments about how outstanding my signals are all over the West by day and the country by night. This is a side benefit of good grounding, besides a slight improvement in noise reduction noted. I know different rigs have different and worse noise blankers in them, but if you have not tried this with your rig, you might be pleasantly surprised. I will also be trying to address my ignition noise problems further. Toroids on coax at antenna and on control and power leads route were installed initially, and good insurance against RFI feedback and pickup problems on all bands in my view, and intend to put new plug wires on the spark plugs, and replace the spark plugs as well next maintenance period at Toyota, which I hope reduces ignition noise where noise blanker is not needed. standard operational procedure. Bottom line, rig working great, as is both receive and transmit. Hope my noise blanket tip helps you and others. Thanks a lot. And that was signed by Carl. Les Cobb goes on with other illustrations between pages 28 and 29, in fact going to 30, about noise and ground answers. If you have a problem like that, and you have a sight problem or other reading inabilities, contact a local ham as an Elmer and have him or her help you read through this rather interesting and somewhat technical article. Just a reminder, folks, you're listening here on the Courage Handy Ham System for the digest reading of World Radio Magazine, April 2008. My name is Bob Zeta. My call is N1BLF. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, right near Buzzards Bay and good old Cape Cod. Let's go to 1010 International. 2008 is an election year. I guess we all know that by now, huh? The author here is Gerald F. Gross, G-R-O-S-S, call W-A-6-P-O-Z, Whiskey Alpha 6, Papa Oscar Zulu. 1010 International holds an election this year. Unlike elections in the United States, the 1010 election has no primary, caucuses, or Super Tuesdays, just a general election. This year, the offices of vice president and four directors are up for selection. The term of vice president is 2 years. The term was changed at the last board meeting from 4 years, and the term of directors remains at 4 years. All terms will commence on 01 January 2009. An elected official participates in determining the direction that 1010 will take in the ensuing years. Each director is responsible for a different area of 1010, such as net controls, awards, QSO parties, public relations advertising, publications, chapter relationships, internet, conventions, or scholarships. A director or officer will help determine how 1010 supports the 1010 International Net Scholarship Foundation and how members' dues are allocated. 1010 bylaws specify that any member who is current with their dues and has been for the previous 4 years and is currently paid up through the term of office for which they wish to be a candidate can apply. There are 2 ways to become a candidate and secure a space on the ballot. The first and most often used method is to apply directly to the nominating committee. The second method is to petition for candidacy. Before each election, the current president appoints a nomination committee chairperson, who in turn populates the committee with members who will work together to determine the eligibility of each candidate who applies through the nominating committee approach. The committee does this by requiring each candidate complete a short questionnaire and write a short personal biography, 200 words or so. The second method to get on the ballot is by petition. A candidate using the petition method must submit a petition signed by at least 50 currently paid-up members and also a short biography. In order to be a candidate, you must either have submitted your name to the nomination committee prior to 01 June or have your petition sent to the 1010 secretary by 01 July. The ballot and candidates' biographies appear in the July 1010 news publication. Ballots must be returned to the tellers by 01 October, and the results are announced on 01 November. The 2008 Nomination Committee Chairperson is Ken Harmon, H-A-R-M-O-N, call K-1-I-E-Q, Kilo 1, India, Echo, Quebec. His 1010 number is 31363. Additional information regarding the nominating process may be obtained by writing to Ken at his address, 471 Turnpike Road, Mason, M-A-S-O-N, New Hampshire, N-H, 03048-4722, or by email to k1ieq@juno.com. 1010 will be at the Dayton Hamvention this year. Come say hi, sign the log, find out what 1010 is all about. We will be in booth 326 on the wood floors just east of Forum Room 1. The 1010 board meeting will be held in San Antonio, Texas on 31 May, and on June 1, you will find many of us at the Hill Country Picnic at the home of Jack Moore, K5CC, member 50708. If you live in or will be in the area, give Jack a call and stop by. For Jack's address and phone number, visit the 1010 website at www.ten-ten.org and look under 1010 Officers. I think it's time to take a trip to Mars. That is to say, military affiliate radio system, hi-hi. Marsgrams, make a comeback. Author Bill Sexton, N1IN, is Mars call sign AAA9PC. The magic word was My Mars, and this is its story. For the better part of 15 years, U.S. fighting men and women abroad mostly did without the free telecom services provided by ham radio operators in earlier wars. Mars Grams traveled free and fast, but email and cell phones were the modern way to go. That's what we were told, and commanding officers evidently agreed. More than a few in the military affiliate radio system felt, wrongly, but no less emotionally, that the Mars Grams' evident demise cost the organization its chief reason for existing. To these members, hardly anything seemed as fulfilling as the gratitude of lonely service members and families kept in touch across the seas by amateur radio. Then, just before Thanksgiving, morale and welfare messages by the dozen abruptly started flowing to Iraq and Afghanistan, and at a steady pace unseen since the first Gulf War in 1991. As one message from Baghdad put it, "It's raining Mars grams." That's a good sign, huh? Actually, all it took in a society hooked on email was the obvious matchup of the domestic internet with the hero WinLink messaging system pioneered by Army Mars. That and the astute initiative of two Mars members, both reservists on active duty. How it came about is a wonderfully instructive story. Not only what a couple of hams were able to make happen simply by stepping up to a challenge, but also the wealth of amateur resources ready to support their foray into leadership. In Iraq, there was Scott Hedberg, AD7MI, AEN5AC. Major Hedberg took his ham radio gear with him when deployed early last year to help train Iraqi forces. An ardent Mars participant, Major Hedberg had previously fed exercise Mars grams into Operation Garden Party, the amateur radio demonstration last October on the grounds of the United States Capitol. Stateside, there was Jeff Hammer, N9NIC, Alpha Alpha 9, RWL, of the Indiana National Guard. Captain Hammer already had served in Afghanistan, where he established the first Mars station. He wrote about it for QST Magazine a couple of years ago. Now he was home in Indianapolis awaiting redeployment to Iraq. Thinking of his unit's needs during the approaching deployment, Jeff Hammer messaged Scott Hedberg inquiring about Mars Gram availability in Iraq. Sadly, Hedberg had to report very little traffic. Minuscule, he put it. Then he set to work remedying that, starting with a message back to the states for help. At that point, teamwork took over, a multi-layered effort that reached from Fort Huachuca, Arizona, the headquarters of Army Mars, to Army Mars Region 11 in Germany, and on to the Persian Gulf state of Qatar, where an American ham took over relaying Mars grams into Iraq. The forwarding operation tells a story in itself, but let's first look at the bottom-line results of Operation Mars Gram. Within 24 hours of www.mymars.org going live, the date was 19 November, its filled-in-the-blanks message form had delivered the first 8 Mars grams to the WinLink server operated by Army Mars National Internet Coordinator Chris Carson in Georgia. 2 days later, Thanksgiving Eve, the count had reached 208. The end of the month total was 309 for soldiers abroad. Christmas was much the same story, only better. For the months of December, My Mars logged 511 outgoing messages from 47 states. Clearly, Operation Marsgram had taken hold. The bulk of holiday traffic was addressed by families and friends to service members in Iraq. In addition, stateside Mars members had a special address of their own in Germany, the Lentz-Dahl Army Medical Center, where the most serious casualties from Iraq and Afghanistan are treated. Individual holiday messages addressed to any injured soldier were distributed among the patients by Suzanne Harland of the American Red Cross. Not only Scott Hedberg, but others in our region are seeing Marsgrams in quantities we haven't seen in years, said Daniel Wolf, the volunteer Mars director for Europe, Southwest Asia, and Africa. Marsgrams going to the Lentz-Dahl Regional Medical Center were arriving by the dozens every few hours. Thanking Wolf, the Red Cross's Heartland messaged, "There's nothing like a note from home to brighten up a day in a hospital." So the question arises, if email and cell phones are so handy to most soldiers, why the sudden upsurge in Marsgrams? Scott Hedberg knows why. One truth throughout armies past and present, he wrote in a message posted on the ARRL website, is that mail, that's real mail that you can touch, is critical to morale. Here in Iraq, it is no different. In this day and age, the Marsgram may travel most of the way by radio, but when it's delivered, it is a piece of paper you can read and reread and cherish. The initial exchange between Hammer and Hedberg soon resounded within Mars leadership back in the States. Jim Hamilton, the Region 4 Southeastern Mars director, fielded Hedberg's inquiry about an available website. He immediately fired it off to Chris Carson, the Internet coordinator, as well as Mars headquarters at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, and Windlink coordinator Steve Waterman in Tennessee. As it happened, Carson's My Mars URL was already up, and he also had a software utility for auto-filing Marsgrams in proper military format. All the sender had to do was fill in the blanks on his or her computer and hit send. With help from Gary Buskowski, a script was written that fetched the destination state slant country from Marsgram text and created the appropriate Windlink address. Messages thus moved seamlessly from Internet to Windlink without human intervention. With that groundwork completed, Army Mars Chief Stu Carter brought the full membership into the project. Simultaneously, Major Hedberg blanketed his military contacts, in particular, the family support groups organized for all deployed units, with instructions on how to send a message via My Mars, one word. He also worked with his regional Mars director, Dan Wolf, organizing that end of the Windlink delivery system. Ron Bell jumped in to help with sorting traffic routes through Germany. The Windlink server operated at Gutter by Curtis Knott captured messages for a relay onto Hedberg station in Iraq. That's when Hedberg's work really began, printing out the messages, addressing the envelopes, hand-delivering them to units at his own camp, and turning the rest over to military postal service for the quick last mile to units in the field. All this in his time off from official duties as a military intelligence officer. A lot of effort goes into getting these messages delivered once high-frequency radio lands them in Iraq, Hedberg wrote later. Units that regularly push mail out to smaller forward operating bases run the risk of a roadside bomb or small arms fire just to ensure soldiers get their letters. Reacting to the precipitous onset of holiday traffic, Chief Carter said Operation Marsgram looks more and more like a great success. And when his Internet coordinator proposed deleting the holiday designation and making the program permanent year-round, Carter responded, "Let's do it." That means a continuing workload for Carson and Hedberg, of course. What's the motivation for keeping the Marsgrams moving? Hedberg's answer is, seeing the look on a soldier's face when he receives a Marsgram, priceless. "I know because I've just been delivered them by the dozen," he said. Nice article by Bill Sexton, N1IM, Mars Call, AAA9PC. Bill can be reached by sending snail mail, That's U.S. Postal Mail, too. 105 West Road, Richmond, Massachusetts, M.A., 01254. Or by email, too, sextonw at juno.com. SextonW@juno.com. Folks, any of you who get this material are somewhere in the vicinity of Boston, Massachusetts, there's an urgent plea out for operators who are going to be needed for the Boston Marathon. The 2008 Boston Marathon needs you. The Marathon Amateur Radio Communications Consortium is looking for ham radio operators to assist at the marathon, which is held annually on Patriots Day. This year will be 21 April 2008. According to recruitment coordinator Bob DeMattia, K1IW, amateur radio operators are needed to provide communications support at the start line, along the course, and at the finish. If you plan to be in Boston for the race and are interested in volunteering to the communications effort, please sign up at the Marathon Amateur Radio Communications website at the following, marc.amateur-radio.net. That's marc.amateur-radio.net. This information was provided by AR Newsline. We're at the 56-minute mark, folks, on this digest reading of World Radio April 2008, being supplied by the Courage Handy Hemp System and its marvelous facilities. I've been reading World Radio and QST Magazine in digest form for the Courage Handy Hemp System for probably 4 or 5 years. It's been a wonderful experience for me. And for those of you that don't know it, you can also hear this one or the other every first Sunday of the month from the Talking Information Center, the Massachusetts Reading Network. It's at www.ticnetwork.com. They have a hobby show called Leisure Pursuits, and amateur radio has its time with my recordings of World Radio or QST, alternately, on that time frame. But they cover every conceivable kind of reading material, just pleasure, information, weather, novels, magazines, you name it. So if you've never checked ticnetwork.com, and you do have internet connections, you might be pleasantly surprised. You would just have to click on Listen Now, where the prompt is, and you could hear them all day long instead of listening to the same old stuff that's on talk radio in your local community, because some of that can get pretty bad. I think you'd agree. And as we conclude here, I'd like to ask you for any comments, suggestions, recommendations, criticism, constructive ones, of course, about the way I present the material. I don't have time to pre-read any of this material. It's just read cold by me, and I try to give it proper inflection and not talk too quickly. You probably notice if you listen to me for any length of time that my voice sort of varies in quality. I'm getting old, and it tends to get raggedy during perhaps 30 minutes, 40 minutes, and then levels out a little bit. But I'd like to know what you think anyway. Just encourage me, I suppose. Hi. If you have internet, you could drop me an email at my call sign, which is n1blf@comcast.net. November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot, n1blf@comcast.net. I'd love to hear from any of you about what your thoughts are. Maybe I can improve the reading according to your suggestions. Thanks a lot. I've been reading World Radio Magazine, April 2008, published by Armand Noble. The editor was Nancy Cott, WZHC. World Radio can be reached at 2120 28th Street, Sacramento, California, 95818. Their phone number is area 916-457-3655. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It's for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website is just wonderful. It's done by professional people to make it easy to use for anybody that chooses to want to look and listen. It's www.handyham.org. www.zeidaradio.org. Again, my name is Bob Zeida. That spells Z-E-I-D-A. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, down in southeastern Massachusetts, right near New Bedford, Buzzards Bay, and good old Cape Cod, 7388.